This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 263 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along.
This episode is sponsored by True Botanicals. Most skincare products on the shelf involve some sort of trade-off. Either they're loaded with harmful chemicals, but they work, or they manage to have clean ingredients, but then they do absolutely nothing for your skin. True Botanicals believes you shouldn't have to choose between skincare that's safe and skincare that's effective. You deserve both.
With the help of leading researchers from top universities, True Botanicals bottles the highest quality natural ingredients, creating luxurious formulas that are as potent as they are pure. Third-party clinical trials verify their product's efficacy. Their Renew collection for aging skin outperformed Crème de la Mer, and their Clear collection for acne outperformed Proactive Plus. Proof that non-toxic skincare can not only be as effective as conventional skincare, but it can be better.
And True Botanicals is the first skincare company to have its entire line certified safe for people and the planet by nonprofit MadeSafe, America's first non-toxic seal.
Go to truebotanicals.com now to get free samples and receive $20 off orders of $40 or more off your first purchase with the code Outlander.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are pushing ever forward on our Drums of Autumn read-along. This is a big week, guys. I think we did the math, and I don't know if we haven't been doing the math because we've had the dates for a while now.
But what?
We did the math.
Who schedules all this? Of course I do the math.
I'm just saying, clearly we haven't redone the math since the November 4th date was released, because once we did that, we realized we need to do more than one chapter a week. So this week, gird your loins, people. We are covering four chapters.
We've been doing more than one chapter for quite a while now. We've done one if it's super long, like 40 pages or whatever. But we've been doubling up for at least since after Comic-Con. But shiz got real because we had recorded Ailey's interview. And then we had recorded Aga's interview. And we had an episode of the read-along or two in the can. And because of some travel that I recently did, and then because of something else, like, thank goodness we had some stuff in the can. But it's been a little while. So since we had two interviews, that's wonderful. We love sharing them and speaking to old friends and new. But that really eats into our schedule when we're trying to get done by the time the show starts. And of course we will, even if we, God forbid, had to have more than one episode in a week, or if we had to do like 10 chapters. Well, we'd never do 10 in one episode. We would maybe record them if, God forbid, we had to do that, but it would be at least two episodes. So we would just have to push out two episodes or so in a week to get it done. But we will be done, as we have with seasons 1, 2, and 3, by the weekend before the season starts.
So, that being said, we're doing four chapters this week. And I feel like we grouped four chapters that I literally are like Schadenfreude for me.
Well, not just that, but, and I'm not going to lie. So when Summer puts out the schedule or makes out the table for all the chapters, she groups them by part because that's how they're arranged in the book. And we try our best when we combine stuff not to straddle parts. It's okay if it's like a two short parts or one. We prefer to not go into a part. If a part, which happens, consists of only one or two chapters, and those are both super short, and we have to go with others, that's fine. But we don't want to split a part needlessly, especially if it's super short. So other than that, though, so Summer puts that out on the spreadsheet before we open it up for people to claim chapters to contribute to. And I take that, and I start to schedule it, or that's how I group it. We start off with chapter by chapter, and then if we need to do it or there's a super short chapter, we'll double or triple them up. Very rarely triple until we get now, like balls to the wall time. Well, when I grouped, we were going to do two this week. And then when I reevaluated everything, I was like, nope, we're going to do four this week. And so when I put them all together, I didn't look at the content. I didn't look at the structure. I didn't look at what was in them. But as I was reading,
hurts my feelings.
I was like, holy heck, I did this pretty perfectly. I mean, it's all the shiz involving Roger is in these four chapters. So
not just Roger.
Oy.
Point is these were some real uncomfortable chapters to listen to for me.
I didn't listen to them. I read them, but yeah, very uncomfortable to read. No, it's not. They're not all highlighting Roger, but these four chapters lead us to what's going to happen with Roger.
Right. I feel like this is... these chapters, and especially I would say probably the first chapter, 44, was a lot like a slow motion car wreck where I could see it coming and I knew what was happening because I remember I've read this book. This is probably the book I've read the most because it was the first book I read.
Okay, I keep forgetting this, even though it's been the entire book. This has not been anything new that we didn't know. It's come up in the last two or three read-along episodes. We've mentioned the fact that this is your first book.
This was my first book.
Oh, so my God.
It's like slow motion car wreck. So it's like, oh, God, it's happening. Oh, it's going to happen. It's happening. Oh, and now it's happening. And it's happening. And then the aftermath. And you're like, oh, God, look at what's left. Like, I wanted to stop reading so many times. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I could just skip over this. And I was like, I can't, because I guarantee you, if I skip over any of this, this is going to be the section that Ginger has like
questions,
readings from, and what do you think, Summer? And I'll be like, wait, what? So I read it all, listeners, all of it. I suffered through it for you.
Not for them, for you.
And side note, totally unrelated, my coworker who's in the cubicle next to me is currently reading Voyager.
Oh, and yay!
I know. And I turned to her today and I was like, I am so excited for you. I was like, and I'm also a little bit jealous. And she's like, jealous? Why? Yeah. I said, because you get to read it for the first time.
Ugh. And that's your favorite, right, Sam?
Voyager?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say Voyager is my... It's hard to say, because I would say that Drums of Autumn for me is one of my absolute favorites because it was the first. Mm-hmm. And then I loved Outlander.
And it was the fourth.
Yes. And then I loved Outlander, well, actually, of course, because the fifth. Yeah, right. So, and then, of course, I love Outlander because it's Outlander, the one that begins the whole story. And then Dragonfly and Amber I threw across the room. And then,
which of course, Voyager was my favorite. I loved
because it's all about ripping them apart, right? Universe ripping them apart. And then Voyager is how we put them back together. And that's why I love Voyager, because of that, and Print Shop. So, but then we come to this book, and this one is just so meaningful to me because if it weren't for this book, I would never have found any of the books. So,
and that means yes, I would never, I may have found them. You may have found them. It just wouldn't have been in that.
I mean,
same
you
time.
Clearly found it in German in another country.
Well, that's true.
You just didn't read it.
No, and I might not have read it. But yeah, so we're happy to be with book four. I still can't, and I know I'm getting way ahead of myself, but I still can't believe, like, okay, we're going to finish book four. We're going to have season four, which I'm already tripping in a good way. And yeah, I know we have to get through book five and season five before we get book six, but holy crap doodles. When we were in Scotland, and I know you guys are like, oh my God, Ginger, I've heard this 83 times. When we were in Scotland for our first Pod Abroad 2018 this year. And it's like, I swear to you, everything freaking happens when I'm overseas. And a lot of times when you're with me. But this year we got the renewal. What was it? We got the renewal and the month. So we got November. We didn't get a date yet. And we got the fact that we got five and six. And I was like, yeah. Oh my God. So yes, I know five is between four and six. But It doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter. We get six. That's all I care about. Five is going to be rich. We're gonna have fun. That's going to be, I don't know. All I know is six is after number two. Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be my, honestly, probably
my favorite. If somebody was listening to you talking right now, they'd be like, her math skills are so bad.
It's okay. It's all good.
Six is obviously after two. Like, seriously.
Stop it. Okay, I think we have some chapters.
All right, so we're going to start our read-along tonight with chapter 44, entitled Three-Cornered Conversations.
It is October 1769. Jamie is chopping wood, having let young Ian go to the mill where he could flirt with some Quaker lasses. Better them than some young native girls. Quote, he hadn't forgotten what Myers had said about Indian women taking men to their beds as they liked, unquote. Now, remember, young Ian is not a virgine. And number two, that was like obviously tongue in cheek, but this one is not. Number two is not. Again, we do our best. We apologize if we make mistakes. We are human, but we do our best when we're discussing the book, discussing things. We use the term Native American or Native or Indigenous as much as we possibly can. That was a quote I just read. And I know I don't want to stop after every time I use it from a quote, but at least probably once an episode is not too much. Anyway, so yeah, remember what Myers? I just think of Myers and I think of the balls, but or the balls, yeah, the thing. But yeah, that I remember him talking about that. So Jamie is out there sweating like a fool. He's sweating from exertion and he's thinking of Brianna wrinkling up her nose at the smell of a sweat-soaked shirt because it was stinky. And so he decided to save it. He took the shirt off so it wouldn't get sweaty. But as he's thinking of Brianna's reaction, it was the same thing that she said and the same expression that his mother had said to him when he came into their home stinky.
Well, see, that's a double-edged sword because my daughter does things. She makes facial expressions that my ex-husband did, like that are clearly mannerisms of my ex-husband. So it's like, it's not just the ones of the people you love and remember fondly. It's also the ones that you no longer love. And quote, try to remember fondly.
What a mystery blood was. How did a tiny gesture, a tone of voice, endure through generations like the harder verities of flesh? Unquote. Now, I agree with that. I think we've all seen examples of this. And something I find fascinating, although depending on the circumstances, like what the people you're talking about, there might And I, to be honest, or to, I will say I haven't looked into this. I just know from my own experience that I never purposely sat down and practiced my dad's handwriting. I did practice my mom's handwriting because I wanted to learn how to sign her name.
Ginger, nobody practices dad's handwriting.
I know.
That's what happens when you've broken both your hands and you're writing with your feet.
Oh, Summer. That's just mean. Dad, we love
Ginger,
you.
He has terrible handwriting. He's not listening.
Anyway, I never set out to emulate him in that way. My mom, I did. Number one, I think she has beautiful handwriting. But number two, she was usually the one who signed. No, I did not forge checks. But she was usually the one who signed a lot of checks and signed things for our school, like late notices.
No. I only forged dad's signature because it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I could just scribble nonsense and they're like... Ginger, you worked way too hard. You needed to learn how to be way less into that. Yeah, because I figured out
hold on.
I was
step back. Take a look at what you just said. Out of the two of us, who's the one to take on the more difficult thing and try and perfect it? You know that's going to be me.
I'm not saying you're not. What I am saying is that you worked too hard.
I worked hard. I agree.
Had you thought about it. It was way easier to forge anything from our father because everyone knew you couldn't read it anyway. So
how many times did you ever do a late notice or a sick notice?
Too many times to count.
In high school or junior high?
Oh, high school.
Oh, high school?
But I'm pretty sure I tried mom's handwriting a couple of times and I was like, this is never going to work for me. This is never going to work for me.
Except so, you know, you both look have at your different handwriting.
You look at your strong suits and clearly going with my dad's chicken scratch was the way to God. Go. It required no effort. It was just like, blah, blah, blah. I didn't even have to make sense.
I was at work. It must have been yesterday because it wasn't today, but it was very recent. And I was writing something, some assignment I'm working on, and I was given a name. And it just so happens that our dad's name is Mike. And it just so happens that this guy's name was Mike. So maybe it was the fact that it was the name. But I didn't notice the whole name. I only noticed the first letter, M. But someone was telling me about this assignment, and I was taking notes. And I wrote down this contact's name, Mike. That's all I had. And after I wrote it down, I stopped and looked at it, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's my dad's, not my dad's name. I said, that's my dad's handwriting, M. I mean, it was spitting image. So all this to loop this back around to Outlander people, yes, like expressions and words or the way someone says something, definitely I can see be genetic. Oh my gosh, handwriting? That kind of freaks me out, but I'm thinking handwriting is almost genetic. Because I mean, I know I saw our dad's stuff, but I never, ever tried to write like him. I never practiced.
Again, nobody tries to write like that until they need to get out of school.
At least we've gone from, I think it was two episodes ago or so, at least we've gone from accidental, not incest, to his handwriting. It's a much safer topic.
Definitely cleaner.
Oh, yeah. Well...
yeah. Not his handwriting. That's illegible.
So Jamie takes his shirt off to not get it stinky and sweaty, and continues chopping. He loves all of Jenny's children, but Brianna, she was his own. He thinks of Frank and wonders if Frank had been the better man for taking in Brianna and Claire. And then he breaks the axe.
Stop for a moment. I'd like to go back to that statement.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he did take in Brianna, but Jamie took on helping to raise Leary's kids. How is he any different? He was raising Marsley and whatever the other one's name was.
Joan.
I don't remember the name. Yeah, Joan. Thank you. He stepped in and was raising both of them.
I don't think he's not thinking. Well, he is. He's not thinking about whether he's a good person or not. Because him raising Marsali's kids was
not Marsali's kids. Lyra's kids.
Oh, sorry. Marsali. Well, that's wrong. Him raising Leary's kids is not a matter of him being the better man. He married her knowing she had children from her first marriage. That's a lot different than having a spouse who disappears, comes back pregnant, and you accept that child as your own. So I don't think he's, I do think Jamie's a mensch, absolutely. And it was very nice of him to care for Leary, and dude's still taking care of Leary financially.
Exactly. But my,
and care for her kids.
My point isn't so much that the situations are the same, because they're not. They're totally different situations. However, the outcome is pretty much the same. He's raising the children as their own. And it's the same thing. And he's like, I don't know that I could do that. I'm like, dude, you've been doing that. So I don't know that he's a better man. He just, and I honestly, I think that had Claire come back in the same situation, I think that Jamie loved her enough to do the same.
Oh, I think he would. I think he could and would. Absolutely. I'm just saying, I don't think Jamie sees the two situations as the same, even in the end.
Okay.
I don't think he does. Because if he did, I think he would allow that for himself. He would allow that thought. But the fact that he thinks maybe Frank's the better man means that he does not see the two situations as equal. So Brianna and Claire go out foraging. Jamie tells them to be careful, and says that he's smelled natives about. And he explains it a little. He says this is the time of year, the autumn, when they'll be drying venison, and he knows what it smells like. So he's just like, be careful. After they leave, Jamie fixes the axe head, and he thinks of the coming winter. Quote, It was odd, though pleasant, their three-cornered way of talking. He and the lassie were a bit shy yet with each other, inclined to say personal things to Claire instead, confident that she would pass on their essence, their interpreter in this new and awkward language of the heart. Unquote. But now he gets real. He loves his daughter and is thankful for her, but he wants to stoop Claire again in his bed. He's thinking of building Brianna her own place for her and Lizzie. Yes, because she's a grown woman. Yes, because they deserve their own spots, but mostly, well, not mostly. It's all rolled up together, but he wants his wife back. Just about this time, Miss Lizzie appears and is seemingly scared of something. Young Ian isn't to be seen, and then Jamie hears him. He tells Lizzie to tell Jamie. Something has happened. Lizzie says that she saw a man at the mill, someone that she recognized. She'd seen him with Brianna at Wilmington, and she says it was Mackenzie. Ian said he didn't know anyone from Leah like him, meaning a Mackenzie that he might have come across, and his speech was maybe a Highlander, but schooled in the South, so it was that he was an educated man. Lizzie says that they knew each other, Brianna and this man, and that Brianna was afraid of him. Lizzie describes the scene in the tavern when Roger had come and found Bree. And she describes how she'd left with him and how she'd not come back till early dawn and how she could smell him on her, his seed. And then she spills out the final thing, as if she hasn't just dumped enough on Jamie, that Brianna is with child and that Mac, Mackenzie, must be the father because she was a virgin when she had left Lizzie.
See, now what this says to me is that you need to do your own laundry. Like, seriously? Like,
I thought you were going to say Lizzie needs to do her own.
No, it just Lizzie never, needs to mind her business. This is why you should just do your own, take care of yourself. You don't need other people doing your laundry. You don't need other people cleaning your beds. Because this is what comes of it. And especially if you have an impressionable young girl who doesn't understand all the things and put all the pieces together to create a puzzle that didn't match the box. Like, they all seemed to fit together in the reality she created, but she put together a puzzle that was not the puzzle that was on the front of the box. So
Jamie then sees it all, or he thinks he does. He realizes that he had seen it. Quote, all the small things he had half seen and half thought, not allowing them to rise to the surface of his mind, came together at once in a logical pattern. Unquote. Now that right there reminds me of Diana and her little puzzle board. Sorry, that's All Souls trilogy there. So Jamie knew that Claire knew. She was a physician and she was her mother and she was a woman. There's no way she didn't know. And he knows that she hadn't told him. And we learn, or Lizzie says, that Brianna hadn't had her courses in 2 months. And then Lizzie had seen the man at the mill. Jamie knows well the possibility that this Mackenzie could lay claim to Brianna and her child.
Could you imagine your friend, just any friend of yours, going up to your parents and telling them that you hadn't had your period in 2 months?
And that you went out one night and came back and you smelled like someone's seed.
And there's... oh, she smelled like semen. And we'll get to that in the next chapter because...
that's Summer's favorite word.
It's not. And also, I'll mention it then. It was just... anyway.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm like, could you imagine anyone in your life now, like literally like airing your dirty laundry like that? Literally.
Only you if you are extremely worried about me.
Ginger, I'm never worried about you.
Don't be like that.
Why would I worry about you?
What, worry that I'm never going to have that on me? What are you talking about?
Could you imagine? I'd be like, what? Dad, listen up. I was doing Ginger's laundry last week. And it smelled like straight up cum.
Oh my God, Summer, stop.
And there may have been blood.
I can't.
And,
you can't
and
talk like
then
this.
Following that. She has not had her period. And I know that because I do her laundry and I throw out the garbage.
Oh my, well, that's why.
Actually, this is probably why we don't live together anymore.
Why? You never did my laundry.
No, but I could tell all your secrets.
What? Yeah, that I
know she's pooping because she's singing the special song.
Summer. Oh, no. It's called She Lit the Special Match.
There you go.
Oh, so, Lizzie, excuse me, Brianna. Wait, what? Oh, sorry, not Brianna.
I'm not reading your notes.
Jamie's mom. Jamie's mom.
Ellen?
So Jamie's own parents had married through such a device, fleeing until she was pregnant. This is, of course, Ellen. Then her family, Ellen's family, was forced to accept Black Brian once her pregnancy was far enough along. Ian stole Mackenzie's horse. And that, I gotta admit, that made me laugh. I don't know why. They're like, yeah, he's on his way here, but we're slowing him down. We're buying us some time. Well, yeah, I took his horse. But surely he was on his way. And to make sure that he didn't, like, come in the wagon, they left Rollo in the wagon and no one would be stealing it. Jimmy says that Wakefield has left his coming over long. Stop it.
Sorry.
And they had one thing to do. Jamie has Ian grab his pistols. Lizzie is to wait for the women, but she's not to tell them where Jamie and Ian are going.
Yeah, just like she didn't tell Brianna's dad that she saw what she saw. She's terrible. She's a bad secret keeper. She is not the secret keeper.
Eugenia E. writes, the name of this chapter, Three-Cornered Conversation, made me think of a tricorn hat that was popular during this period. I don't know if Diana did this deliberately, although she always has a reason for her titles. Anyway, I thought of the hat when I was reading the beautiful description of Jamie, Claire, and Bree's interaction during the beginning of their relationship as a family. This chapter is written in the third person, so we get a nice insight of Jamie's thoughts as he chops wood for the hearth. It flows like a stream of consciousness where one thought leads to another and then another. The feeling of warmth when looking at the pile of wood, the memory of his mother when thinking about Bree's expressions, the thought of Frank taking Jamie's child as his own. Lizzie Weems seemed to be a minor character when we first meet her in Scotland. She is the girl that Brianna takes as her maid before boarding the ship to the colonies. She witnesses the encounter between Bree and Roger in Wilmington and creates a story in her mind. Her misunderstanding of the events shakes their relationship when she tells her version no less than to young Ian and Jamie. If only Lizzie had told Jamie that Bree said she knew Roger rather than causing such a kebby levy. She, who seems so harmless and fragile, is going to precipitate future actions of important of very important characters for books to come.
Let's be more specific. If Roger had told everyone that he was going by Mackenzie in the past instead of Wakefield, they'd be looking for a Mackenzie and not a Wakefield.
Yep.
So,
yep,
the crux of this issue is that. But also, I don't know why I'm surprised every time Lizzie rats on him, because she does nothing but create her own little melodrama every time she comes into something. Like, she's just, there's always a little bit of something going on around her between the malaria, other people's storytelling, and what's to come in future books, all the things, drama. All right. And that was chapter 44. Now moving on to chapter 45, entitled 50-50.
Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins with Claire and Bree on a foraging expedition. Claire avoids an elderberry bush covered in ripening berries. They are not ready to be picked. Claire says, you wait until they're nearly ready to drop from their stems. This opening to the chapter is a foreshadowing of what is to come. The ripening berries are a metaphor for pregnancy. Claire and Brianna are on that walk to forage. Claire is eyeing an elderberry bush for wine and for drying, but they're not ready yet. Brianna is learning the landmarks of the area. She notices a big rock that looks like an Easter Island head. That's the type of landmark that won't change with the seasons, and that's why they're so important, especially as someone who's so new to memorize. As they separate to forage, Claire keeps an eye on her. She knew there was something going on, something wrong. She notes that she has Jamie's trick of hiding strong feelings. Part of the reason she'd arranged for this alone time was to have a conversation that, if she is correct, they wouldn't want to have in front of others. She just pops out with it and asks her how far along she is. Brianna says 2 months. Brianna seems relieved that she doesn't have to shoulder this burden alone any longer. And she realized the extra worry, Claire does, her daughter has now about Roger finding her. Claire thinks and calculates and says that she's got to go back to the Stones, like now, to Scotland. She knows that a woman can go through pregnant, because she had, but she doesn't think that you can take a baby through the Stones. And if she stays, Brianna, with the baby, she is stuck. Well, for a while anyway. But it's almost November. Ships won't go until March. And she can't wait that long. If she does go now, how is she to make sure that she'll arrive in the right time? Claire had Frank at the other end. Bree had done all of this thinking already. Galus Duncan had gone farther than 200 years. So she's like, look, Mom, there is no guarantee I will get back to the same time. Claire mentions that there are other Stones.
You can potentially take a baby through the Stones, but you are taking a very large risk because you cannot ask a baby, do you hear the Stones? So there is potential that if the baby has the gene, they can also go through the Stones, but you don't know that. But there's a pretty good chance that they can, given the fact that both Roger and Bree can hear the Stones.
Yeah, that's probably,
so I think they could.
Claire mentions that there are other Stones, that Scotland is not the only possibility. These, of course, were on the island of Hispaniola in a cave that we know as Abandawe, or in the series, Abandawe. It makes me want to say, Abandawe, 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 Abandawe. What is that song?
In the jungle. I'm not singing it.
Okay. So they chat. What?
I just said, oh, okay.
You knew where I was going.
I wanted to make it stop, but like a freight train heading down a very steep terrain.
Every time. Summer, do I ever stop?
I wish you would. Just once.
Then we,
just once.
It's like, it's a highlight of the show.
Just once. I wish that my feelings mattered. Just once.
Just once. Isn't that a song too?
Yeah, it is.
Da, 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 da.
See? Okay. Okay.
Okay. Oh, Lord. So they chat about her time at the cave with Galus and the gems, etc., and how Galus is now dead, because Brianna was, for a hot second, was like, wait, what? They talk of practicalities. It's too late, though. Bree hadn't planned any of this to happen. Claire mentions all the times she had come to Bree's school to talk about sex education. Bree says, quote, my mother, the sex encyclopedia. Do you have any idea how mortifying it is to have your own mother standing up in front of everybody, drawing pictures of penises? Unquote. And Claire has the best line ever. I must not have done it all that well, since you seem to have not recognized one when you saw it. Oh,
that was funny.
It was very funny. And she says they look different in 3D. Now, before she left her world, Claire had given Brianna a prescription for the birth control pill, but obviously she hadn't taken it. There's no need for it at the time, and she hadn't planned on having relations of that kind with anybody back in the past.
Again,
she was going back.
I think this is all Roger's fault. Again.
That's true.
It's like, you look at all the things. If he had just told people that he was going to be going by Mackenzie in the past, if he hadn't come back at all, she wouldn't be, you know, threatened that she couldn't go back through the Stones. He wouldn't be there. They wouldn't have done what they did. I mean, there's just an endless list of things that wouldn't have happened if Roger had just sat home and waited.
So you're blaming Roger.
Yeah.
Okay. Now they think of Jamie. Oh, heck. The truth was that Claire didn't know what Jamie would do. Jamie was worldly, and this is interesting because when I read this, I'm like, ah, this touches on something that a lot of fans talk about, and this is like legitimately, we can't forget this. This is what Diana says on social media. This is literally lines from this chapter answer or address what so many people say about Jamie and what he would or wouldn't do. Jamie was worldly, well-educated, tolerant, and compassionate. This did not in any way, shape, or form mean that he shared or understood modern sensibilities. I knew quite well he didn't. And Claire didn't think his attitude toward Roger would be tolerant in the slightest. So I know we're talking about Roger, but it's interesting. You know what I'm talking about, right? When so many people say, talk about Jamie and what he would or wouldn't do or what he would or wouldn't accept. And he was such like a man ahead of his time. Well, I think it's fair to say if someone is, I think it's fair to say he is tolerant and compassionate. I don't know about ahead of his time or out of his time, but maybe for his time, he was tolerant and compassionate. But it's kind of like, and this is going to sound really odd, it's kind of like me, and I admit to this wholeheartedly, I like get goo goo gaga with my kitties, whom I love so much, right? I'm like, oh, my baby, or she's sad, or she's happy. Well, you know, that's anthropomorphizing. When you start giving human attributes or human-like attributes to non-human animals, let alone something that's inanimate, it's kind of a, I don't want to say dangerous, but it's definitely not doing well by that animal, right? Because you can't say, oh, she's happy because of this, or oh, she's sad, or oh, she's jealous. Yes, animals definitely have emotions, and they definitely have body language, and they communicate, absolutely. But anthropomorphizing, although I think I do it, a lot of us do it. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is just as you have to be careful in giving, or at least taking it too seriously when you anthropomorphize your pet or an animal. Similarly, you have to be careful in the language you use about someone from the, I know it's completely fictional, but you have to be careful about giving Jamie certain attributes that someone in the 21st century may have. You know what I mean? I think a lot of fans, and I think it's easy for me as such a Jamie fan to fall into this as well, but a lot of fans, I think, I wouldn't say give Jamie too much credit because that's not fair, but a lot of fans pull Jamie forward into the 20th and 21st century.
Well, they expect him to have those sensibilities.
That's what I mean. And that's what I mean by pulling him forward. Yeah. So I just thought I would point that out because I find it really fascinating. And Diana legit like spells out word for word. She tells us what he is and what he isn't. He's worldly, well-educated, tolerant, and compassionate. And this did not in any way, shape, or form mean that he shared or understood modern sensibilities. So there we have it from the horse's mouth. Claire says to her not to worry. Jamie loves her and he won't stop loving her. She says that Jamie will send word for Roger. And then she asks her if Roger knows about the baby. And then we get the best thing ever. Brianna says, well, see, there's a problem about that. It isn't Roger's. Say what?
Dun, dun, dun.
At this moment, the reader, who is not clued in yet, if you haven't read before, is like, wait, what? What is going on here? Oh, Claire is flummoxed. Bree digs something out of her pocket. It was Claire's gold wedding band from Frank. Claire recognizes it immediately and knows exactly where it came from. She says, bonnet? And Bree nods. She wasn't going to say anything, especially after what Ian told her happened to them all on the river. She was afraid what Jamie would do and that he'd blame her, that he'd try to find Bonnet. Claire asks her if he'd hurt her, and that's when Brianna gives us the story of what happened between her and Bonnet. So after, remember when she went downstairs in their or to a tavern, and she saw the ring, her mom's ring. And she knew that she wanted to get it back, or at least find out where it was from and to see if her mom was alive and then maybe get it back. And then Bonnet had said, come, she's like, I'll come to the ship in the daytime. And he's like, okay, yeah, whatever. Well, that's all we heard. And now we see that she has the ring. So something happened between those two points. She'd gone to the Gloriana, quote, cautious but feeling safe by reasons of the number of people around, unquote.
Oh my God. Like, seriously, this is reading just like every Harvey Weinstein story.
Oh, Lord.
Like, every last one. Harvey Weinstein with the whole, like,
I heard Weinstein.
I said Weinstein, but I meant Weinstein. Okay. Like every Harvey Weinstein story that comes out. I thought I was safe. It was crowded. There were people there.
Bonnet was wearing the same clothes as the night before. He tells her she's even fairer in the sun than by the moon. Nice words, Bonnet. Mm. She thanks him and says, do you still have the ring? She wants to hear of her mother at the very least if she can't get the ring back. He says he does have the ring, and it was the luck of Danu that was with him. She wants to know if he'd sell it to her. She says it looks like her mother's ring and asks where he'd gotten it. Something shifts in him at that point. And Diana never says what it is, except, I mean, it might be him thinking or realizing that if that's her mom's ring and then Claire was her mom, obviously he's remembering the incident likely on the river. But I wonder if it clicks that she's Jamie's daughter.
I don't think so.
I don't know. Well, we don't get it, but something clicks in his mind and we see it on his face. Brianna sees it on his face and Diana gives it to us. But we're never told what that is. And that's okay. I'm just curious. He takes her arm and says, come down to my cabin and we'll see if an arrangement can be made. He pours her brandy and she barely drinks it. Meanwhile, he's shoving him back or knocking him back. Excuse me. He says the ring was a love token. She asks if the lady who gave it to him was in good health and covers it by saying it's bad luck to wear jewelry that belongs to someone who's dead. And he's like, I haven't found that to be true. He says that the woman...
He's a fucking pirate. He's a pirate. Everything they take is from people that are potentially dead.
He says the woman he took it from was alive and well when he left her. He wants to know what she'll give him for it. She wants to give him 15 pounds sterling. He's like, ha, I got enough money, girl. Then he asks about the color of the hair between her legs.
Gross.
Okay, if you go from, I have enough money, what color is that hair down there? You need to leave now, girlfriend. Forget the ring. Leave now. No, I'm not blaming her. I'm just saying that's when you leave. She says he's mistaken her, but he says, you've mistaken me. She tries to swing the brandy bottle at his head. He ducks. Thus ensues a struggle. He slaps her, grabs her by her hair, and holds her while he fumbles with his breeches. And then he says Summer's favorite part, meet the rod.
No.
Now, I am curious. This is
no, okay, no, this me. Is...
We'll have to see what the... hold on. We'll have to see what the how the show pronounces it. Are they going to say Leroy?
They say
or
Leroy. I'm about to say Leroy. Okay, probably. Here's my problem with this scene. I have many problems with the scene, but I guess it's not the scene. This is my
Summer's.
This is
jealous.
My no. Ew. This is my problem with Diana Gabaldone and this scene. I know she likes to give things three descriptions. You know, the sound, the taste, the smell, whatever. I didn't need all of those descriptions for his penis when it came out of his pants. So telling me that it smelled like stale urine and, you know, that coarse hair and all the things, like I was like, I didn't need the rule of three when it came to the rape of young Brianna. I didn't need it. It was hard to read.
So I forgot. I was reading going, oh no, oh no, oh no. Like I knew he raped her. I knew that. And I'm not saying one part of this does not count as rape. It all counts as rape. But I didn't remember or realize that he like forced her to perform fellatio on him or at least sit there while he did it to himself. I forgot that part. And I was reading it going, oh my God. Oh, just gross. Gross, gross, gross. So more on the Summer left this part out. Well, she said something, but do you want to say Leroy or Leroy?
I don't care. I don't want to say any of it. I'd like this chapter to be over.
So more on Leroy.
It's got a turtleneck.
Leroy was both uncircumcised and unwashed and gave off a powerful smell of
like
stale
I said.
Urine.
Okay. Can we not say that? Because he's not French. He's Irish and he would not say what you're doing. Yeah.
Leroy. We'll call him Leroy.
Okay, thank you.
Leroy.
I don't even want to say it at all, but if you're going to say it, let's just say Leroy.
I think Leroy. I don't think he would say Leroy.
No, he's...
Because that's too like Southern. That's weird. Okay. He tells her... Oh, God. He tells her to put out her tongue and give him a kiss. Them, meaning him and him and Leroy. He forces himself into her mouth. Quote, he was humming deep in his throat. Wiry hairs brushed her lips.
Like, seriously.
I'm not laughing at I'm laughing at Summer's reaction.
I feel like this whole chapter could have been a couple of sentences that didn't require... the rule of three. And I feel like we're being assaulted along with Brianna by forcing us to be present. I don't want to be present during this. I'd be okay with her just having a few sentences saying, "He raped me, Mom, and it was awful." I would have been okay with that, as opposed to this, which is making all of us be raped by Stephen Bonnet. That's how I feel.
And then that part was over. She's gagging and coughing, and he lifts her, forcibly kisses her, and she butts him in the face. And then she runs. And this part, I think, breaks my heart the most. So she runs, and she runs up, I guess, a level. There are 20 men at dinner who look at her as she passes. The cook reaches out and trips her. Bonnet comes out. His pants or slacks, whatever, trousers are either all the way off or they're around, probably not around his ankles because then he'd probably trip. But they're gone. He's walking around with Leroy at half mast or whatever, like dingle dongle around in front of his entire crew. And he doesn't give a rat.
He is the Harvey Weinstein of the 1700s. And, you know, it's the culture of coverage. Everyone covers for everybody else. This is just what dude does. And, you know, we don't want him to be mad at us. He makes sure that we all have food and everything else. So we're going to, if he wants to have whatever with the girl, they don't mean anything. They're nothing. They are things to be owned and taken. So it's gross.
Bonnet takes her back to the room again with Leroy. Quote, "Leroy likes games, don't you, Leroy?" She says after that, this is telling it to her mom. She says it wasn't too bad, so bad. She didn't fight him anymore. That part breaks my heart. So he didn't make her undress. He just mauled at her chest. Quote, "He shoved up her skirt and arranged her legs to suit him, humming all the while beneath his breath." Unquote. He spit into his palm and eased himself into her.
Seriously?
2 minutes or three. And then it was over.
Was this necessary? What? How much of this verbatim do you have to read from the book? I literally suffered through this earlier, and I feel like you're doing it again. I'm feeling
the more you interrupt, the longer it takes.
I wish you should just tell me that I need to walk away for 3 minutes so that you can do it.
Minutes or three, and it was over.
Is this over?
She waited. He gets up and leaves, and he tells her the ring's on the desk and to take whatever money she wants. He always pays for his pleasure. He's an honest man, he says.
For a rapist.
And this is true. This is true. Remember, many chapters ago, we made that point that he has his own code and he lived by it. Rightly or however much of a nasty character this is, or nasty things that he does, bad things that he does, he lives by the code that he does have. After not being able to pick up the ring for her shaking hand, she empties the entire contents of the bowl into her pocket. And I wrote it out with a sad face. I said, good girl. If you're going to take what you need, just take every single freaking thing you can find. She puts her shoes on and climbs the ladder to leave the ship. She wanted to pretend it hadn't happened, but now with a bebe on the way, she can't. She was raped by Bonnet 2 days after she lay with Roger. And the reason she thinks it's not Roger's? Because he withdrew and Bonnet didn't. The chapter ends with Claire's sharp wit. Quote, "There's a word for people who depend on that particular method of birth control. Parents."
Mm-hmm.
Unquote. Lisa T. writes, "When Bonnet stole Claire's ring, it was as though he stole her past and Frank. This is a parallel to Outlander when BJR literally steals Jamie in prison. Bonnet rapes Bree, but Bree does get the ring and the symbolism of it back from Bonnet. BJR rapes and tortures Jamie, but Claire takes him back from BJR. Bree tells Claire everything about Bonnet, just as Jamie did at the Abbey. In comparing the rapes, that sounds like a forensic show now, Bonnet assaults Bree in many of the same disgusting ways. With, of course, one main difference. BJR was living out a sadistic obsession with Jamie, whereas Bonnet is taking advantage of the person in front of him without a care. I would also add that there is a third rape mirrored here as well, that of the king transactionally raping Claire as payment for freeing Jamie from the Bastille. Not only does Bonnet see raping Bree as merely a business transaction, just as the king did with Claire, he calls his nasty member Le Roi. In French, Le Roi, same spelling, means the king. This chapter is all the more poignant because it brings back memories of other rapes and their aftermaths. Afterwards, Bonnet offers Bree the ring and money. He, quote, pays for his pleasures, unquote. Bree thinks about Bonnet as she tries to take Claire's ring out of the small bowl of rubbish. He takes, quote, a reckless and savage delight in the taking with no knowledge at all of the value of what he stole, unquote. This is specifically how he differs from BJR. BJR knew exactly what he was stealing when he raped and tortured Jamie. This also harkens back to when Bonnet robbed Jamie and Claire. He thought he was taking gemstones and a gold ring. Symbolically, he was taking Claire and Jamie's future in terms of wealth and Claire's past with Frank's ring. Bree giving the ring back to Claire is a symbolic restoration of her past with Frank. Bree's the only other person who truly understands that. The gold ring is the last bit of Frank that is left, and thus deeply meaningful to both Bree and Claire.
I think the only person who's not going to be super excited to see that ring is Jamie.
Huh.
He's like, yeah, I let you have. I don't mind that you wore it, but I also didn't mind that it was gone, really. And now it's back. Moving right along. That was chapter 45. Here's your bonus chapters for the week, people. Chapter 46. More things I hated reading. Comes a stranger.
So we are around the same time of chapters 44 and 45 that they're happening. Roger is afoot, looking for Bree, and he is hot on her trail. Quote, if he'd had to have his horse stolen, it was some consolation that he'd been close enough to reach his destination on foot. This just makes me laugh. Poor dude. He's got his valuables. We believe they're gems he left Bree to get, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quote, he looked a right villain, he thought ruefully. No way to meet your in-laws, unquote.
Having read this whole chapter, I feel like the loss of his horse is the least of his worries.
His beard is the least of his worries. Yeah, all of it. He's berating himself for not having been honest with Bree, and he hopes she'll forgive him. As he continues on the trail, he's greeted by a party of ravens. Make that an unkindness of ravens. Yes, I looked that
up. No, it's crows
after
that are murdered.
After he'd passed their nesting place, he thinks, he's no longer in danger. Now, quote, and where's Alfred Hitchcock when you need him? Roger says. And Diana's about to answer, well, he's showing up pretty soon.
I think he's in the 60s.
We find he's... No, he's about to show up.
Mm.
We find out that Roger had gotten two gemstones from Bonnet. He wonders how Bree's reunion with her parents had gone. The sun's going down, and he continues down the trail, and he hears something, and he sees it's his own horse that was stolen. Quote, a tall young man emerged from the wood beside the horse and stood pointing a pistol at Roger. Unquote. The young man didn't smile. Then Roger sees another man. Quote, he wore a faded hunting kilt whose browns and greens blended into the grass and the brush as his flaming hair blended with the brilliant leaves, unquote. Quote, it was one thing to be told Jamie Fraser resembled his daughter. It was another to see Brianna's bold features transmuted into power by the stamp of years and fronting a personality not only thoroughly masculine, but fierce in aspect. Jamie says, you'll be Mr. Mackenzie.
Mm-hmm.
Roger steps forward. Jamie asks what business he has with his daughter. Roger is now beginning to become alarmed. Just what had Bree told him? Roger says, maybe not the smartest thing. Quote, I've come to claim my wife, unquote. That was it. The boy says, oh, no, you're not.
I mean, it was just the most unfortunate choice of words because...
It feeds into exactly what
right,
Jamie's afraid of.
Exactly. Had the whole conversation with Lizzie and Ian not happened where, you know, he's worst case scenarioing that some blackguard dude, blackguard? Is that how you pronounce that? Blackguard? A bad dude is going to show up and have hurt her and then said, no, she's carrying my baby and now she's mine and I'm going to continue to hurt her for the rest of her life and take it out on whatever children we may produce from this union. So him showing up and them not having the full story and him claiming her as wife in front of them was literally the worst thing he could have done. It just kind of inflamed the situation, don't you think?
Yeah, but there's stuff, of course, that there's so many layers to this.
There's always
so many
more.
But yeah. Jamie says, I'll ask only the once, and I mean to hear the truth. Have you taken my daughter's maidenhead? That's uncomfortable.
Could you imagine?
Could you imagine if you have
your homecoming date showing up at your house and your dad's meeting you for the first time and he's like, I'm only going to ask you once and tell me the truth. Have you lain with my daughter?
No.
Awkward.
He stammers, but in the end says, this is also not the smartest thing to say. Damn it. Yes. She wanted to. That last part, if he said, damn it, yes, stop right there.
It's
that
true.
That was all Jamie needed.
Yes, but he doesn't know. Like, that's the, it's like the slow motion car accident I mentioned earlier. It's like he doesn't know that Lizzie told Jamie that he's the one responsible for hurting Bree because Lizzie doesn't know there was a second dude. And, it's like every romantic comedy, the third act of any romantic comedy, when whatever happens, there's like some subterfuge and then somebody, whatever happens and they get caught and they have to come clean and tell everyone about the horrible thing that they did. And that thing that they say always happens in front of a room full of people. And I always feel so embarrassed for them that it's physically painful to watch that part of the movie. I always hate that part of every romantic comedy. And I feel like while this is not a romantic comedy at the moment, it's like that scene where I hate reading it. And I didn't want to read this chapter, but I did.
Jamie begins the process of destroying Roger. This is the time when fans of Roger begin to maybe not appreciate what Diana does to him.
like for real though, what did Roger in her brain do to her that she felt the need that he was the one she needed to torture? I mean, she tortures them all. Let's be honest. She does torture them all in equal measure. However, it does seem like for a very long period of time in between this book and the next book, for sure, that she just like zeroes in on him and is like, you haven't been hurt enough. I need to hurt you a little more.
Roger begins to fight back. Jamie smashes his face and Roger falls. He says at one point, that's enough. Jamie says, not nearly enough, and knees him in the mouth. As they tussle, Jamie grabs Roger's testicles and squeeze.
That seemed offsides. I mean, clearly they're not. I mean, it was definitely below the belt. I mean, but they're not boxing. And in a life or death situation, there are no holds. You know what I mean? There's no holds barred in the things. But that just seemed really like,
he was already on the ground.
Right. And it seemed like poor sportsmanship on behalf of Jamie. Of course, this was not a game.
No. Roger goes unconscious, but not before thinking, I'm going to die before I've been born.
It's true.
Oh, my Lord. That was funny. Megan P. writes, why, oh, why did Roger not use his real name? What a mess this is about to ensue.
See?
Why don't men talk things out more? Jeez, a simple inquisition surely could clear up a few things here.
Now, I feel like almost all books, this is true of almost all books, if the two main characters ever sat down and just had a real conversation and laid it all out there instead of talking to third parties and getting hearsay, there's your conflict gone. But at the same time, it's so hard that that's the one thing and all it needed was a simple conversation to avoid all this mess.
The one time Jamie isn't thinking logically or with a plan of some kind. But then it is his only living daughter. He didn't even let him talk. This is awful. I love Roger's thought here. Well, to F with good family relations then. I'm with you, Raj. Dude, Jamie was not playing around, y'all. He thoroughly kicked Roger's arse from the ridge to kingdom come. Mercy. If this isn't an oh crap, what now moment, I don't know what is.
And that painful chapter. Those were two really bad chapters right in a row. Like, I feel like when we're not out of the woods yet, this next chapter is still not easy. It's easier. But that's just because we don't know the full measure of what went down yet. But this is kind of like a little respite in the horribleness that was the last two chapters. But moving on, chapter 47, entitled A Father's Song, which is funny because he doesn't sing.
Jamie comes back in after dark to Claire. No one had been hungry at dinner. Brianna and Claire are waiting expectantly. This is the evening that Bree told her mom of Bonnet.
I bet Brianna's waiting more expectantly than Claire is.
The same day. Bree says she'll be all right, meaning in her conversation with Jamie. And Claire thinks that all will be okay in the end, but it's getting to that point that was iffy. While Claire wondered the various reactions Jamie might have, she knew what Bree would do. She knew, quote, how precarious her calm demeanor was. Let him say a bruising word to her and she would flare like a striking match, unquote. Jamie comes in. He says he'd wash by the creek, but he's very late. He says that Fergus came and asked to get a hand with some chimney stones, and Ian had gone too. He was staying over. Claire notes that, quote, something seemed different about him, though I couldn't think what. He said he'd dropped a stone and might have broken his finger again. That's why he came home to have her tend it. Bree looks at his hand. He has swollen knuckles and scraped skin. Claire does her woo-woo juju and finds the line of the crack in the bone. She splints it. And she still thinks something was definitely off this evening.
Did she hear the echo?
What happened? What had actually happened at Fergus's house? Erica B. writes, Jamie finally arrives back at the cabin, says, with Sans Ian, and starts lying about where he's been and who he's been with. All I'm doing is yelling, liar, liar, pans on fire at my nook. Sigh, this won't play out well at all. It's just a matter of when. Bree asks if she should tell him tonight. Bree asks Claire. Claire says that Bree will rest better with him knowing, so yes, do it after he eats. Then Claire notices that his shirt is torn. Erica B. writes, so here we are with Bree trying to find the perfect time to tell her father about being pregnant, and my brain thinks, damn, she's lucky she won't have to deal with her period for 9 months at a time where there weren't pads or tampons. I'm often surprised that Claire, Bree, and Roger have acclimated so easily, in the sense that they aren't ever saying something like, I wish I had some toilet paper, for example. The idea of suddenly going without something that is such an everyday item in modern day living, long term versus short, like if you're camping, has got to be very hard, and yet there hasn't been any whining about it. I know I probably would be. What about you, Sam? Would you whine about it?
About which part, sorry?
Not having some of the modern conveniences like toilet paper?
Definitely. It depends. They had substitutes, and it's only a matter of time before Sears starts making catalogs.
From the 18th century?
Sure.
It's more than 100 years.
Ginger, it's hyperbole and an attempt at a joke.
Okay. Jamie speaks to Bree in Gaelic. Oh, my heart. And then he reaches out and puts his hand on her stomach. Oh, boy. And now she knows the reason for Jamie's otherness this evening. He puts his hand to Brianna's face, and she replies, oh, da, I'm sorry. He says it'll be all right, and she says, no, it won't. Joe B. writes, along with Claire, I am waiting for the piano to drop, for the events circling around the ridge to crash into each other as Jamie and Bree have to face each other in the matter of her pregnancy. The relationship, new and untested, that Claire, who uses activity to distract herself from unpleasantness, can't settle to a task, is a sign of her own distress and the distress she is inputting to both Jamie and Bree. Jamie, too, is obviously distressed, unable to hide his emotions, as is his wont, and this distresses Claire further. It's interesting that Jamie and Bree have the beginning of this conversation in Gaelic, the language of his heart, and perhaps for Bree to share in a way that is theirs, although surely Claire understands enough of the language to hear the real question in, "Do you tell me true?" Jamie says that all he knows is that he and Claire will stand by her and not see her shamed. Then comes the dance of words. He asks her if Lizzie was right, that she had been raped. Bree answers that she didn't think Lizzie had known. That's because she didn't.
Well, she did. She did. She just she didn't know that she knew.
She just had the wrong person.
Right. She didn't have all the facts laid out.
Correct.
In the correct puzzle box. Like, she put the puzzle together and forced a few pieces.
It was a lucky guess. Yeah. She hadn't told her. Lizzie had guessed it, he says. Jamie then gathers her on his knee, which was kind of funny to read about. He says he will see her safe married, and she says she can't marry anyone. She can only marry Roger, and he won't want her when he finds out. Jamie says if he's a decent man, it'll make no difference. Now that the information is out there, Claire weeps. Brianna hadn't wept either, but now she did in his strong arms. Joby writes, I understand there are layers underneath the apology Bree offers Jamie, but it angers me too, as a woman of now. She too is aware of the newness of relationship between her and her new father, and although she is upset by the situation, she can see what this might mean to him. I don't think she apologizes to Claire. I'm yet to be convinced she needs to apologize to anyone. Jamie offers comfort, but his typically masculine approach to distress in a loved one is one of, I must solve this problem, and betrays his moral code and adds to Bree's distress. He sees his offer to find her a husband and a father of the baby as doing his duty and caring for his daughter. Her horror at this concept, at the concept of marrying Roger solely for the benefit of the child, is not only due to her love for Roger, but due to her seeing a marriage where there is unbalanced affection. It is Bree's fear that she and Roger will become like Frank and Claire. They stayed together because of her, and she doesn't want that for herself, her child, or Roger. Jamie says he's hungry. Claire goes out to get some milk. he wants a drink as well. And she asks the sky, what are we going to do? Back inside, she finishes preparing dinner. And my favorite line of the chapter is this, quote, put your trust in God and pray for guidance, and when in doubt, eat. Erica B writes, ha ha ha, I love that Claire suggested she would go get milk when a drink was suggested. Jamie is telling Bree that when he was living in the cave after Culloden, he would imagine he was holding her as she was a baby and sing to her. She asks him to sing to her, and he does. She notes that when he sang, that what he sang was a father's song, a litany of providence and protection. And actually, I think it was Claire, because Brianna has no idea. Brianna also learns that he's tone deaf.
Something we've known for years.
Yep. Jamie keeps singing and says to her, sweetly, you weigh as much as a full-grown deer. But he doesn't want her to move. She tells him in Gaelic, my love to you, father. And my heart breaks. In response, Jamie gathered her tightly against him, bent his head, and kissed her forehead. Bree goes to bed, and Claire wanted to sleep, but, quote, trouble lay on the house tonight, and there was no peace between them. Jamie's a bit restless and asks her to come out with him to walk. She finally asks him what he'd done with his hands. He says, did Brianna tell you anything about the man, his name? Claire says, yes, but she didn't want me to tell you anything. You know I have a hard time keeping things from you. Please do not make me tell you. He says that he can wait to hear it from Bree. But back to his hands. He says that it's a case of, you know, hit something and you feel better. Claire tells him that no, the man didn't hurt her physically. The conversation touches on Wentworth. Jamie is wondering if it's as bad to be violated if there's no physical reminder of it. But then there is, isn't there? They get into a bit of an argument. Claire is saying he doesn't know what it's like to be forever changed by bearing a child. He says that he knows about being violated. He says most of what Randall did to him, he would have stood. But Randall wanted his soul, and he had had it. His point was that, was this man a stranger to her, who only took her for a moment's pleasure? If it was only her body that he wanted, then I think she will heal. But if he knew her, was close enough to want her, and not just any woman, then perhaps it might be that he could touch her soul and do real damage. Claire is horrified. Didn't he do real damage? Jamie still is insistent. It is different, Claire. Claire says, no, it is not.
It's not. And she's going to look at that damage every day, forever, and remember.
Jamie tells Claire that it's not her body that matters when he takes her. And he wants her now, but he will not go to her with the memory and image of what Randall did freshly resurrected. Joe B. writes, having soothed her daughter, Claire goes to Jamie. I don't agree with his solution to the problem, but I sympathize with him by having to be so clearly reminded of his experiences with BJR, adding to his burden. He can understand rape far better than Claire. Claire herself has to deal with the feelings of Jamie and Bree, and now of herself. Her guilt for the life she lived with Frank and the impact that has had on Bree. They head back to the cabin, and Jamie asks if Roger will stand by her, meaning Bree. Claire responds with, would you do it if it were me? He honestly has trouble answering in the affirmative immediately. And then he says yes. He realizes that she's speaking of Frank. She says he stood by her. She tried to make him leave, but he wouldn't. And he loved Brianna like his own. She says that when Frank came to her bed, she couldn't forget Jamie. If she could have, things might have ended differently. They might have been able to make a life together. We learn that Frank had been told by the doctors that Claire had been raped and abused and was having delusions. He finally believed her that she wasn't having delusions or that she was telling the truth in a certain aspect. But the thing that was hardest for Frank was that she loved another man and that she wouldn't stop loving him. Quote, he was better than me, Frank was. He could put the past away, at least for Bree's sake. But for me? Hold on a second. Sidebar. Did Frank really put away the past?
No.
As far as for Bree's sake, he did. He never brought it up to her in her face. He never did anything. He was great dad to Bree. No one disputes that. But did he actually truly leave it in the past? We can't say too much right now, but we know of letters to... We know from the earlier part of this book, right, that there were letters to Reverend Wakefield. Mm-hmm. He didn't leave it. That's not even Reverend... Book two. When Claire goes back to... before she goes back, right? And they're cleaning out stuff from the reverends. They find stuff. So yeah, did he really put the past away? No. But it was slightly different in the series, but he definitely didn't want Claire to bring it up. And he's a little bit hypocritical here.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jamie says, and so you lived 20 years with a man who couldn't have forgive you for what was never your fault? I did that to you, no? I am sorry too, Sasanek. This scene is another gut-wrencher from Diana. They both are apologizing for things that, hard to read. They go back to the house and Jamie says, I hope Roger Wakefield is a better man than the two of us, Frank and I. Mind you, if he's not, I shall beat him to a pudding.
Too late.
You kind of already did.
Right?
She ponders how he knows she loves him. If she doesn't say it, she wants to know, like, Jamie, do you know I love you? Would it help if I said it more? He says he knows because she's there. She says going through the stones is not something you do for the sake of a friend. Not all who TT come out alive. She says She tells him she loves him. And he says, I'm glad of it, Claire. Very glad. Come to bed now. I'll warm you. Erica B. writes, the whole scene with Jamie singing and Claire getting supper ready is really quite sweet. They are clearly quite comfortable in each other's company to make comments about each other. I can only imagine the warmth in Claire's heart, the sight of her daughter and her father together. Much of the chapter is quite moving, and I sincerely hope they keep most of it in the show. Who else wants to yell at Jamie? You did beat him into pudding. Mm-hmm. Grr, this cannot play out well. Joe B. writes, probably in response to her declaration, Claire, in need of reassurance, asks if Jamie knows she loves him. So much has been uncertain in her life. She is pulled in different directions by her roles as wife and mother. She needs the clarity of this relationship, if nothing else. Jamie has the gift of gab. No kissing of the Blarney Stone needed. An ease of words is part of what he has always offered Claire. Way back in Outlander, she says, quote, lacking experience or the pretense of it, Jamie simply gave me all of himself, unquote. And she responds to it deeply. She still does, as do we. I know my Pinterest board is full of Jamie quotes. So rarely does Jamie hide his feelings from Claire that she doesn't doubt he loves her, but she doesn't have that gift. Jamie knows that too. What she does have is her presence and her support of him. Claire is with him, and she doesn't have to be. She risked so much and gave up so much to come back to him, including at that point, Bree. She wouldn't do that if she didn't love him. It's part of the story. She breaks into prisons, sleeps with kings, travels 200 years, jumps off ships in the middle of the ocean, and that's just the highlights reel. Even in deciding to stay on the bridge with its risk and isolation is part of her demonstrating her love. Because she loves him, she is here, and she, of all people, could choose not to be. But she acknowledges the importance of words to Jamie and offers to say it more. Of course, he'd like it, but he returns her gift as he says that he wouldn't like it too often. It'd lose its novelty. But what they can both share equally is the warmth of their bed.
And that was chapter 47. That was chapter 47. Join us next week when we will be doing, I believe, three chapters. Chapters 48, 49, and 50. And as always, if you want to join us to continue the conversation, head over to our Outlander Pod group on Facebook, www.outlanderpod.com/group.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us on Patreon. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important way is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family about the Outlander Podcast. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.